Welcome to the next episode of Flint Co. Talks. It's your boy Dano. We're in St. Louis today, and I am graced with the presence of Mr. John Alberisi himself, the chairman emeritus of the Alberisi Corporation. John, welcome to Flint Co. Talks.
Right back at you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it is great to be here. I really appreciate you taking the time today. And for those listening, this can be a chance to get to know John a little bit better. We're going to talk about kind of John growing up. We're going to talk about some of the things he loves to do, write music, loves to bake. So we're going to jump into that today. And so, John, without further ado, let's start with maybe your earliest memories of growing up Alberisi and what it was like in the family business and kind of what you saw going on around you before you came to work here.
Sure. Be glad to. And the family goes back a long time. So I'll try to get back to that and then tell you where I came in.
Okay.
My grandfather came over from Parma, Italy, and he worked for a company in New York, an engineering company. That company sent him to St. Louis for some projects that they had, and this was back in 1900. The Historical Society here has yearbooks that chronicle who was here in any given year.
Okay.
And the earliest year that I could find him listed was 1900. So that's approximately when he came to St. Louis to do the projects that the engineering company had in front of him. He liked St. Louis. There was a lot happening there then. You know, we had the World's Fair and we had the Olympics and other things that were happening, and it was a going place. Well, my grandfather thought this was a real opportunity. Sent for his intended from the old country, and she came over by boat. They got married in New York, and they came to St. Louis and never left. So that is the historical part of how the family came to be in St. Louis. And the orientation was that my grandfather started on his own to work in St. Louis in 1918. So that was the next step in the evolution of the company. Now, when they moved to St. Louis, they didn't choose to live in the Italian enclave. And we've got a very strong, it's still the Italian neighborhood in St. Louis called The Hill. But they chose to stay with, let's say, the American side. Not because he was ashamed or reticent about being Italian, but if you take yourself back, 1900, 1910 were in a war in Europe, and Italy was not on the same side.
Yeah.
And so even in the Second World War, they chose to be on the other side. And so being an Italian did have some issues. My grandfather, without trying to anticipate that, said that his family would be American. They didn't speak Italian in the household as I understand it. My father doesn't understand Italian today. We'd think, well, it would be a great thing to be bilingual, and that's a wonderful thing. But at the time, they were more interested in fitting in as Americans, and that was the direction that they took, and that's was a powerful thing for them at the time. After 1918, the company was pretty much just a small local contractor, and that was fine. But the family was being raised. It was my father was the oldest. His sister Mary, other sisters. I had a lot of aunts. And so that was developing over those next years. When my grandfather passed away, and it was rather sudden in 1940, that it really fell to Gabe, who had been working in the company for maybe 10 years at that point. and his oldest sister to step in and continue the company and the contracts that we had, and then decide what they were going to do after that.
Mm-hmm.
So my father and Mary formed a partnership. Gabe, my father, did the outside supervision, did the marketing, signed the contracts. He was the outside person.
Mm-hmm.
Mary, his sister, was the inside person. She ran the office. She did hiring for that. The accountancy was all in here. What was HR back in those days,
mm-hmm.
Was her responsibility. And providing everything for the office fell under her. Now, you kind of take it for granted today. Well, you know, a woman is going to step in and do all of those things. But you have to take yourself back. This was 1940. There weren't a lot of women in construction at all, much less being a partner in a construction company. And it worked because they both had their own niche and they stayed to it and depended on each other that they didn't have to worry about the other part of it, because it was a family enterprise and they were going to manage it that way. And that was fine until Mary retired.
Mm-hmm.
And her stock was bought by my father. And that really consolidated things. And it was easier after that, because although my father and his sister really worked together well,
mm-hmm.
they were different personalities. My father was much more aggressive and doing things and taking on work. My aunt was more to, not to take it too far, but she was conservative.
Mm-hmm.
When Gabe wanted to buy another crane, which was a big investment.
Oh, yeah.
Mary said, if one crane was good enough for Grandpa, it's going to be good enough for us. So that's the kind of rift that was in the company. Not that it drove it apart, but it was just a different style of outlook in the company. My father, for his part, understood this, wasn't going to question Mary because she had good ideas of her own.
Yeah.
But he started a materials company
mm-hmm.
with my mother being the accountant and really doing the back office side of that in our home.
Okay.
And he would buy equipment, trucks, eventually cranes and things that would help, because he understood that that was something that we could do ourselves.
Uh-huh.
It would make us a stronger company because we weren't dependent on others, whether they had the equipment that we were going to have to use. That was something that we could provide for ourselves and profit by it. And so that materials company and where they were storing the equipment became our yard, and eventually the fabrication shop was put there. But that was separate because Mary didn't want to go along with that. Now, once she retired, now Gabe could do things the way he wanted, and that was really where the growth started, although we were still very small. Now, you have to understand, we had like a compound at that time.
Uh-huh.
And my grandmother's house was in the middle. She was still alive for a long time. She lived a full life, and the aunts grew up, got married, left that house, but she still was there. We had the house next door.
Mm-hmm.
The office was in a house on the other side. And my backyard had a wall there because that was the warehouse. I used to throw a ball against the wall. I thought it was great. Everybody should have a warehouse in their backyard. And that's how we grew up. But it was like a compound, and the maintenance and the materials that we had were all readily at hand. And then we bought this other property that would become the yard and the fabrication shop. So we were expanding, but not to a great degree. It took a long time for that to happen. It was a measured growth, and that wasn't the idea, except that Gabe had his own goals.
Mm-hmm.
So that worked out well, and there's a lot to know about Gabe, and I think that it's easiest to learn about him through some stories. And there are a couple I can share with you.
Yeah.
He was a very strong person. Physically, he was very strong. And mentally, he was really adept at what he was doing. He would get to the bottom of everything, learn everything there was to know about it before we actually got into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was smart. He was strong. So let me give this example, a story that came from the field. A laborer that we had told me this story, and I think it's generally well known.
Uh-huh.
But this laborer was a big African-American mountain of a man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a real mouthful. So to make it shorter, they just called him Tiny. I understand. There's some irony there. But anyway, so Tiny said, I was working on a project site. And at the time, Gabe, my father, would go out and visit all the sites during the week. Because we were all here in St. Louis. It wasn't like we were spread out at that time. It was very local.
Mm-hmm.
He would take his big Cadillac out to the projects because he wanted to be seen. He wanted to be noticed. It always had to be a bright red Cadillac because he liked red, and he wore a red tie every day, everything. The company colors were red and white. It appealed to him.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Tiny tells the story of this afternoon when it was a cold winter day. The red Cadillac pulls up. Well, everybody looks a little bit
on edge. Yeah, it's time to get busy.
Yeah, it's time to get busy. So Tiny is working on some foundation, shoveling out some a hole for a foundation. Gabe comes by, looks down in the hole. He says, Tiny, you look cold. Tiny says on himself, so I was. And I said, Mr. Gabe, because that's what he called him.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Gabe, it's really cold out here today.
Mm-hmm.
Gabe thinks about it, and he says, I've got just the thing to help with that. He goes back to his car. Well, Tiny says, I thought he was going to get some heavier gloves, maybe another jacket to put on, something that would really help.
Mm-hmm.
Gabe comes back with a shovel. He takes off, and this is Tiny telling the story, takes off his hat, takes off his overcoat, climbs down in the hole with me, Tiny says. And Gabe says, Tiny, if you can keep up with me, you won't be cold the rest of the day. And Tiny said, I wasn't. Everything worked out that way. Now, why am I telling that story? What does it really prove? That Gabe wanted to show off or that he was in shape or whatever? No, that wasn't it. What I think Gabe was really trying to demonstrate, and once that happened, Tiny spread the story. Everybody knew that story the next week. But what I think that Gabe was getting at was, you're here doing the work. I don't send anybody out to do work that I wouldn't do myself or that I couldn't do myself. But I can't be everywhere, so Tiny, It's your job to get in this hole and to do the work that you're hired for. And for that, you'll get a good paycheck, take it home to the family. You'll be proud of what you're doing every day. You'll see the progress every day.
Mm-hmm.
That is the message I think Gabe was sending, because it really created ripples throughout the organization. Gabe isn't going to have to come down at all with me. I'm going to get my work done, and he's going to be thinking, I'm glad I have Tiny or whoever on the project.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you another story. Because Gabe, as much of a leader as he was in the field and culturally, he really cared about St. Louis and did all those things. He could be single-minded about things too.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty strong-willed. And we had just completed an addition to the old office over on Kinlan Avenue here in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And the project manager for that expansion had hired an interior decorator in order to fit out the office with the office furniture and et cetera. And one of the conditions that Gabe said that was adamant to him was that we had red carpeting. Did I mention red?
Yeah, red.
So he wanted red carpeting all over the office. This was taken back to the new interior designer by the project manager, and the didn't get a good reception. The interior designer said, we can't have a red carpet. You're going to have people dragging dirt and mud into the office, and red shows every stain.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wears, then if you have to replace a section of it, you'll never match what that red color is mm-hmm. with anything that you want to do. So you can't have red carpet. Well, now it's up to the project manager to go back to Gabe and explain why they can't have a red carpet.
Uh-huh.
And Gabe is in his office. The project manager comes down. Gabe, you can't have a red carpet. That's mm-hmm. from the interior decorator. And here are the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
He went through the litany of reasons. Gabe just looks up and he said, that's okay. So the project manager is a little surprised.
Uh-huh.
This is so cavalier.
Uh-huh.
And he gets up to leave the office, and he turns around and goes back to Gabe, and he says, Gabe, do you understand that you're not going to have the red carpet you wanted? Gabe said, that's not it. We're going to get a new interior decorator. Now, that message gets back, and all of a sudden, there's red carpet everywhere. Every part of the building is covered with red carpet. Now, did Gabe jump up and say, this pound on the table? No.
Mm-hmm.
No. He found a different way of getting the message across that was what he wanted, but not maybe what was expected. But that is something that he got his way.
Yeah.
And everybody took notice of that, the ripples through the company, the same way. That story spread, and you could do things however you wanted,
mm-hmm.
as long as it was Gabe's way. And why did he do that? Because he was really looking out for the company and the institution that he was building,
mm-hmm.
that it would have the values that he had. He would have the preferences that he had. It would live the way he was living his life. He was a man of faith. He was a man of the community. He was also a great family man. And he wanted the company to reflect all of those things, even if it was a small thing like the color of the carpet. And that got around, and I think Gabe got through to people without raising his voice, without going into antics, that it was going to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would be better off just to do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have to do it twice. Everybody learned from that. So with Gabe, it was persuasion, but not overt. But everybody understood.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the way Gabe looked at it is, If you got that message and didn't understand it, why are you still here? We need people who can learn from what they do, not people who think they know better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're welcome to get the input. He listened to the input.
Sure.
He made his own decision.
Those are great stories. They're representative, I think, somewhat of kind of what the company is today, because I feel like the leadership today is in the same position he was, that they wouldn't ask somebody to do something they couldn't do themselves or had done themselves, which I think is really important, right? As a young manager, or even as an entry-level guy, I was a field engineer, and that taught me a lot about understanding how the crews worked and understanding the importance of communication with the crew and understanding how long it actually took to form a wall or tie rebar, which really helped me in my communication skills. But it able to communicate with the field hands, but Gabe jumping in the hole, that's a great story, jumping in the hole and said, okay, Tiny, keep up and you will not be cold today. I love it because that's it's almost leading by example. And
absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that is a strong message to get across.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that we have kept that. And I'm sure it was the same thing with Mr. Flint and Flint Co., that he wanted things done the way he knew they should be done and insisted on it. And I think that from the culture that we've seen with Al Boese, with Flint Co., they are so close because they had family origins.
Mm-hmm.
And those values are passed on easily through a family, maybe less easily in a corporate setting.
Mm-hmm.
But if you keep that family feel and people can learn those lessons that they have from both lecture and example, that it really creates a strong organization that keeps those values over time.
And I feel like we have those values. We have those, the family feel. And we talked about it with Greg in the other podcast, really, of, you know, you get that great feeling of accomplishment because you're working with folks that are, you know, could be considered your family, right? That's, we spend more time here at work or working for the enterprise than you do really anywhere else, right? And that's, you want to have the big family feel so that coming to work is actually something you would look forward to, right? And be a part of a great operation.
Absolutely. And it makes you feel like you are a success, and that just breeds more success.
Mm-hmm.
When people feel confident about what they're doing and how they're doing it, and that the company is not putting stumbling blocks in the way,
mm-hmm.
because we don't exactly share your values.
Mm-hmm.
No, we hire so people have those values when they come to work, and it works out well both for them and the company. So I think that having both the theory and the example,
mm-hmm.
carries the company to new levels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful if we don't want to make, and I don't spend a lot of time thinking about history, only because the future is where we live.
Mm-hmm.
We don't live in the past.
Right.
But we have to appreciate the past to find out how we got to where we are and what that meant at the time so that we can keep those values, the culture in the company for generations.
Yeah, for many generations to come. I love the thought of today being the future and really embracing that and thinking that, you know, today we can be good and tomorrow we can be better. You know, and it's, you can look back at the past to learn, but it's not worth living there because of what's going on today, right now, and how we can seek that excellence in the present moment, or even in the afternoon or tomorrow, and think about how we can move the needle on whatever the operation is that we're doing at the time.
Absolutely. You know, you talked about growing up in the company, mm-hmm. and that was an opportunity that was really gave me a lot of advantages, but I had advantages. And it's not like I was white and all this. No. The advantages were I had strong parents who raised their children well and provided for us what we needed.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a lot to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we lived in one house with three bedrooms for the five of us. There was one bathroom upstairs, and there was no air conditioning, so it wasn't like we were in luxury surroundings. But it was a good upbringing because the parents really cared about the children, and the children learned their place, and we stayed within our boundaries. So I say I had a lot of advantages. And growing up in the company and having the warehouse and the association with the people who were there, the example of my aunts and my grandmother living next door, it was a wonderful time for mm-hmm. me. And I appreciate that. Now, I don't dwell on it because that's the past.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to kind of see where things came from. Where did my father get his strong will?
Mm-hmm.
I can remember a driver coming in with a truckload of whatever and mm-hmm. running over my grandmother's flowers.
Oh, no.
Well, it was a big truck.
Uh-huh.
She came out of that house, went up to that driver, berated him
mm-hmm.
until he got out of his truck and started putting the flowers back where they should be. Now, you don't just get to a Teamster and say, you're going to do what I want
mm-hmm.
Without having a little gumption. And if you look at, well, where did my father pick that up?
Uh-huh.
I think my mother and, his mother
yeah.
had a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's another example. I could see that out of our window because that's where we were. I could go on the back porch and enjoy watching this.
Uh-huh.
So it was a real opportunity, and I don't usually talk about that aspect, but what a wonderful way to grow up
oh, yeah.
in the company with my grandfather naming the company, my parents named me after him, so I was ready to step in. Now, I have to say that I had the opportunity
mm-hmm.
to follow in my father's footsteps,
mm-hmm.
but I never thought that I could be him. He was a strong person. I was never that strong. I was of a different background. I had a different orientation, and I thought that I brought things that the company might be interested in, but we already had a Gabe. I didn't want to be him. For one thing, I could never have been the man he was.
Sure.
That was a realization and a limitation for me, but that didn't keep me from being the best John L. Barisi that I could be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't emulate his work or try to be him, rather to try to appreciate that as a heritage, but add what I brought to the company as an addition, but not competing with him.
Mm-hmm. How long did you work here when Gabe was here?
Well, Gabe was here for a long time. He didn't die till the late 90s, 2000, that was about time. He was 93, but he wasn't the same man later on.
Sure.
And today, I understand that pretty well because I'm not who I used to be.
Yeah.
Not that I was all that much, but you learn that you lose things over time. Gabe came in to work every day
mm-hmm.
up until the time he was in his late 80s.
Really?
And he would be in early, and he would be the in the front office of the old building. And that was something that people got used to, even if he didn't have the strength and the drive he once had. Mm-hmm. They respected what he had done. And he knew his place, but I think that he didn't give up driving until years after he should have mm-hmm. given it up.
That's something we've talked about before. You mentioned that Gabe drove up to the site in his big red Cadillac. I remember when Alberisi first acquired Flintco, you coming to visit the job site. I remember you coming by one of our jobs in Austin, and I just happened to be there. And I remember you driving up in the PT Cruiser, and you got out of the PT Cruiser, and you had some fresh snacks for us, some cookies or something like that. Tell me the importance of that driving and what that meant to you.
It put me in contact with the people in our other offices. And before Flintco, I used to drive up to Canada. I used to visit our office in Detroit. And I think that the effort to drive up and for people to see that I had made that effort, which mm-hmm. was more than if you just stepped on a plane and got off in Canada. But mm-hmm. you had to drive there. You had to, if you were bringing treats, I had to develop a whole group of cookies that were no bakes so that I could hand them out and they would be fresh, because it's hard to have weeks old cookies by the time you got the circuit done. So it was an outgrowth of what I had been doing in our offices, and we had projects that I could visit along the way, and that was always fun to get into contact, see what they were doing, to find people who we had hired locally and get to know them. So it was an opportunity mm-hmm. that I took advantage of. And when we acquired Flintco, oh, man, that was a big territory.
Yeah,
from Oklahoma to Albuquerque, down to Texas. And my gosh, how much driving do you want? Because that provided everything that we, and the PT Cruiser gave way to the Mini. And so I was driving that around, but I used to drive all over. I would drive to Vermont for the insurance meetings and things like that. And people were maybe surprised that mm-hmm. I did that. But I think that if any of the project people were going on vacation, they'd load their kids and their wife and everybody or their husband into their car and go someplace. And they knew that that was their way of doing things. So it should be my way of doing things too.
I think it makes you a real person, or made you a real person, to those jobs that you visited, because as somebody that was recently acquired, you know, or whenever this was, 10 or 12 years ago, acquired by Alberisi, and you hear that the chairman is coming, you expect, you know, the private plane to land up in Georgetown, and you get in the blacked out Tahoe that drives over to the job, and somebody gets out and opens the door for you, right? And then you step out and kind of, you know, do your, I would liken it to the president showing up somewhere, you know, and walks out and everything's prepared with the right way to walk and there's no chance you could trip, but that just wasn't you at all. And that's not you at all, which is what I think is truly amazing. I mean, you just pulled up on the job site like anybody else would and just pulled up, parked in front of the trailer, you get out, you come in, you meet everybody, you brought cookies. We were amazed that you had cookies. That's all we could think of. It's like, did he stay at the extended stay where he has an oven and he brought like a cookie sheet with him, or how is he making these cookies? Like, there's no way that he stays in extended stay every time, or we couldn't figure out. Maybe we thought you were staying with the local VP or something like that. But it was a welcome visit, right? Well, you showed up and as a real person that we could relate to, I think, which is so important.
Yeah. You know, when people welcomed me mm-hmm. onto their project sites, the pride they took in what they were doing, the care they had making sure that the owner was satisfied to do all that, Well, that was a gift to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it was incumbent on me to bring a gift to show how much the company appreciated their efforts in the field.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard life when you are now at a site where it has to be self-sufficient, where you have to do things that encompass all kinds of local connections and such. So you should show appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
So the cookies were a way to just say thanks,
mm-hmm.
everything you do. And besides that, some of the cookies were pretty good.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I think they were
appreciated. They didn't last long.
They didn't last long enough. And around St. Louis, they kind of take it for granted. But when you're going other places, it is a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it shows the attention that we have to those people who make us successful.
Mm-hmm.
And that they can be as successful in their own way. I've talked to a lot of people about bringing themselves to their work. And the cookies were a way to bring an extension of myself to their work, to show the appreciation, the attention that they deserve.
Mm-hmm.
So it became a symbol,
mm-hmm.
in want of a better term. Now, that all came to a halt
mm-hmm.
around 2020
mm-hmm.
because everything shut down
yeah.
because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what to do now? There's no sense in driving to Albuquerque because the office is remote
yeah.
and people are not
had to make house calls to see everybody.
Yes. So the world changed at that point. And so I gave up those trips, and even a couple of years after that, it was still hanging on, besides having long COVID and all of that. There was a lot of reticence about visiting mm-hmm. and bringing any germs that might affect the
yeah.
field personnel. So we pretty much gave that up as distinct trips.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still remembered because people really appreciated the effort of someone coming out, seeing where they worked,
mm-hmm.
seeing what they were doing. And I talk about the pride they have in what they're doing. Construction is great in that aspect because it's so tactile.
Sure.
You can reach out and see and touch and feel what it is that we're doing every day.
Yeah, you definitely can. And I showed up yesterday here to HQ and walked in, and there at the front desk were some nice little chocolate snacks that I might have consumed more than my fair share. But in my defense, it was afternoon, and everybody had walked by them at some point. So that's still something you do today is make the cookies, right?
If you had been here on Monday, you would have had blondies. color is not a problem.
Equal opportunity.
Yeah, I can go both ways on that. But yeah, it's something that you do, but it gives me a wonderful opportunity to take something that is a gift, walk around the office, and if the boss or the CEO or the chairman comes around, everybody gets a little tense because, why are they coming here? Why are they stopping
right.
at my desk? Why are they talking to me?
Yeah.
But if you bring cookies, that's why he's here. He wants mm-hmm. to give me a cookie.
Mm-hmm.
I'd better have one. I'll try that. unless they have a nut allergy, and then
yeah.
maybe they don't take it that day. But it also is the rationale that I use for talking to people, for getting to know them, and also showing our appreciation again for what they do every day. Because we depend on that in the company, and they are so eager to talk about what they're doing and how proud they are to be doing it
mm-hmm,
here
mm-hmm.
that you just think, you know, isn't this symbiotic? We have this relationship where we're interdependent.
Mm-hmm.
And I can bring around cookies and they don't question why I'm there. And if I'm striking up a conversation while they're there, why? That's all very natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe that's a motivation. But again, I just like handing out things that people enjoy.
Whether people will admit it or not, they want to be seen. They want to be recognized. And it's not in a grand fashion where you're sitting in front of 200 people and somebody stand up and being recognized for their work and you're a little embarrassed to stand up. It's meeting somebody where they are, understanding what they're doing, and appreciating them for that. And I think that's it just says a lot about the person that you are or who your parents raised you to be. And I'm grateful to be a part of that. Grateful to have witnessed it and been a part of that and consume the cookies.
Consume the cookies. You know, those weren't bad.
No.
Just four ingredients. I mean, what's not to like about that?
Yeah.
And I've done the segments in the newsletter.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they've come over and they've taken the photos of it. Well, that's fine
mm-hmm.
because I can pass on a kind of fun tradition.
Oh, yeah.
And people can relate to it because when I had the opportunity, I gave them the same cookies or similar cookies
mm-hmm.
out on the project site.
And there's a memory that goes with it.
Yes. And we're trying to keep that now in a technological aspect. We're printing it instead of going out and actually doing it. And the problem with the printing is you don't get the smell of the cookies baking. Which is...
It's just the paper and the ink being burned onto the paper is the smell you're getting, which is not the same.
Not the same. But it is something that I think people appreciate and that I go to the extent of still doing it is relatable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people find that ingratiating.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate the openness
mm-hmm.
with which they... can receive that without it being a demand.
Oh yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your music and your love for writing music. I mean, just this last week, the production of 51 came out.
Yes.
And had a chance to watch that last week. If you're listening and haven't seen it, look it up. It's incredible. Can you talk a little bit about? Let's talk about 51, and then we can kind of talk about some of the other songs that you've written and we've helped produce. But why 51? And tell maybe just a little bit about what happened and why you wanted to write about it.
Absolutely. You know, that happened nearly 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was impressionable. I was just starting to work I've been working for 8 years in the company, 10 years. But it was still something that was so startling to read in the press
mm-hmm.
about what had happened on a construction site.
Mm-hmm.
It really made an impression on me at the time, and it took a long time to incubate.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started working with the folks down in Austin on some other songs, I thought, I want to get back to that. I want to talk about that because it is different than the other kinds of songs that we've done. Songs about safety,
mm-hmm.
that's kind of a crazy idea, but it's not really so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take you back, and we'll get back to 51 because I think that is a great tribute, but also an indictment of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Let me divert for a moment. Why do we do things with music? That doesn't have anything to do with safety. That's crazy. Why are you bringing that into it? And it helps to think about how the human brain
yes.
learns.
Yes.
And I remember back in first grade, Sister Roberta Ann,
mm-hmm.
I still have the marks from the ruler on my wrist. But Sister Roberta Ann taught us in the class the alphabet. Well, that's a lot of letters for a little kid to learn, especially because they're supposed to be in a line.
Straight line.
Straight line. You better have the capitals and the... And she had that little tune that goes with it. And probably every child, whether they go to Catholic school or whether they go to public school, they learn that same song, A, B, C, D, E.
Yeah.
Why do you still remember it? And in fact, I have a hard time going through the alphabet without that tune popping up in my mind.
Yeah.
Why? Because the music and the message are reinforced in different parts of your brain, but it creates that as a distinct memory that you can retrieve. And if you were singing the tune, you'd start going through the alphabet. If you were going through the alphabet, you'd remember the tune. It's just the way we learn. And it made that learning easier and memorable. The whole idea is what they base advertising on today. Just hearing a few notes, five notes, will make you think about French fries.
Really?
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Yeah.
And would you like a hamburger with that? Well, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it is something that triggers in the brain. I can still remember things, but it's the element of having words and music together. If you ask that child in first grade, memorize this poem. Memorize that poem.
Very hard.
What do you expect of
Very
me?
Very hard.
I'm a little kid. I can't memorize something like that.
Yeah.
But you ask them, oh, what is that new Britney Spears song? They can actually sing the whole song.
And dance routine.
And dance the routine, maybe do the whole album.
Yeah.
You think, how can you remember that and not be able to memorize this poem?
Yeah.
It's because it's... one, that they're interested in that, but it's also that integration of the music with the words. Now, let's get back to 51. Here we're having the opportunity to put safety at the forefront and try to make it sticky in the brain by adding the musical element to it. But usually these are lighthearted, at least they're not deadly serious, although that is an aspect, because we've done that sometimes. With 51, we're not talking about what an individual does. The rest of our safety songs are really geared toward how workers protect themselves, how they have good practices, how they can do safety in their work. 51 is different. It really speaks to companies, management, and what their role is in safety, which is a whole different message. And what is their role? Their role is to provide safety equipment, safety learning. It has all kinds of elements that are not the individual's responsibility, but a corporate responsibility to our employees. And 51 describes what happens in the absence of that.
Yeah.
If a company abdicates their role in safety, everything can collapse.
Literally.
Which unfortunately happened. If you don't have the right culture that supports safety every day, those workers may not come back to work the next day. And that is a powerful message.
Yeah.
Now, when I wrote the words, and it was done actually in the first person, I was thinking about a folk song that I had heard, Japanese folk song, about a child, 7 years old, who stayed seven because he was in Hiroshima when it was bombed. And I thought, if I could do this in the first person, that would add to yeah. the relevance of it.
Yeah.
And I sent it down to Tim, Caleb, Omoy, all these folks that had helped out in Flint Co. And I said, I don't have music to this. I know the story because it made such an impression on me
yeah.
when I was first in construction. And I want to tell this story, but I don't know how to do it. I don't know what it's going to take. And, you know, that's my role. I just, you know, throw the grenade into the factory and all of a sudden the fireworks are going off. And when I sent it down to Austin, they thought about it for a long time. It incubated because, one, they didn't know about that accident.
Right.
It is surprising that it is the worst construction accident in the United States, but it's almost been forgotten.
Yeah.
Now, I had, again, an advantage of reading about it, seeing the photos, feeling the pain of the people who now had to live with the results of that, and thinking there is so much our industry can learn from this
mm-hmm.
if we take the time to get outside of our own concerns and see what the impact of an accident, a single accident,
yeah.
what it can have on a family, what it can do to a community, their church, and all, much less having 51 people die at one time, within minutes. Those people who were live workers were now bodies
yeah.
at the base of that cooling tower. That's a powerful message. And when you see how that ripples out to the families,
yeah.
to the community,
yeah.
how each church is going to deal with those mourners and the funeral
yeah.
after that, it is a tremendous impact. And that is the powerful message we're going to get across. Luckily, the people in Austin really stepped up and understood what we were trying to do with this.
Yeah.
And made contact with local people, put the music together, and found an artist who could really emote what
yeah.
we were trying to say.
Yeah.
Now, it was a woman, which is great, except none of the victims uh-huh. were women.
Uh-huh.
They were all men. So we had to do a little rewrite on that, but it became even more powerful.
It did.
Because now
it
creates the aspect of that family mm-hmm. loss. It creates the aspect of what it does to the community and that they were going to have to live with it forever. And that added power to what we already had when they now had the recording of the song. They went further and did the interviews.
Yeah.
And contacted the people who were willing to talk about it. And they were just laid back country boys
yeah.
who happened to be at that place at that time. And their remembrances added so much to the video.
It did.
It really gave you the feeling of being there because mm-hmm. they were there.
Yeah.
I wasn't, but they were. And so that aspect fleshed out all the feelings
mm-hmm.
that they had personal recollections
mm-hmm.
of that.
And seeing their face and their emotions as they talked and told stories was quite telling. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, and they were just good old boys around the pickup truck, and it just conveyed that these were ordinary people who yeah. survived something extraordinary.
Yep. Ordinary people, just like the people who passed away in that accident, but they had regular lives like we live on a daily basis. And like you're saying, the impact is just especially in that community, is like unbelievable.
Yeah. And this is like survivor's remorse. They were there. They weren't the victims, but they knew the victims.
Yeah.
They knew the families.
Yeah.
They knew the area that it was. And it was not a, this is not a metropolitan area. This is rural. And those people had to go to work the next week knowing what had happened.
Yeah.
And living with that. For the people who are victims, it's awful.
Mm-hmm.
But now the survivors have to carry on,
mm-hmm.
especially their families, their spouses, their children, their parents. They have to live with that forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where the power of the message comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the song. The song was a good base. The story tells itself, and it's really an indictment of what happens in the industry if we don't pay attention to that.
Yeah.
What is the downside? What's the worst thing that can happen if we don't pay attention to safety
mm-hmm.
and protecting people and sending them home at the end of the day to their families?
Mm-hmm.
What is the impact? And it's horrible.
Yeah, it's catastrophic. Yeah.
It is. So I think that it really sends an important message, and I hope that people can take that and make it personal
uh-huh.
for their company, for their circumstances. I was talking with one of the people who had seen that Karen Bridboard, and she said, that was so powerful. That was such a good rendition of that. And I said, it is like sending your corporate children out.
Yeah.
What do you do to protect them? Is there a time when you feel like you've done enough?
Yeah.
Is there a time when you feel like we don't have to do more?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that time ever comes that we can say we've done enough or that we shouldn't do more. Now, it doesn't have to rule your day
yeah.
where you're paralyzed and can't do your work. And I always refer to it not as working in a safe environment, but rather working safely.
Mm-hmm.
It's that active
yeah.
safety that is going to give people the best chance of living through that day and the next and doing their job, being proud of it. And if we don't do, as a company, our job, then we have, as I say, indicted ourselves.
Yeah. Well, we have a responsibility. You say, I mean, it's been 47 years, right? It was like 1978, I think, is what the year
yes.
was. So it's kind of, it's already been through a generation, and the next generation, it's not something we talk about, but I think it's really important to bring it back up. Just like you said, if you abdicate yourself from safety, the results are catastrophic. And I think one of the other songs that was produced is actually going to be a part of a safety curriculum that's going to be taught in a program at a high school in Austin, which is great, in the CTE program, the Career and Technical Education, that's going to help the students that are coming into the business realize the importance of safety and help them realize that, hey, it's not just putting on gloves, or it's not just a vest, or not just your hard hat. Like, there's a reason that we wear these things. There's a reason behind it, and it's not worth the shortcut based on what could happen to you in the long run.
And looking out for others, because we don't exist in a vacuum.
Yeah.
You have all of these relationships that you develop on the project, a
yep.
camaraderie of the construction team.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look out for them, and it has to be personal, so that when we're doing things, we think for ourselves, but also we think of the next person on the project.
Mm-hmm.
Is he or she protecting themselves?
Yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
The project? Because nothing stops a project in its tracks like an accident.
That's right.
And in order to have your work, get your paycheck every week, you have to have that as an ongoing basis. So how do we keep each other working safely?
Yeah, and we've taken it outside the walls of just the enterprise, which is what I love about it. I remember the safety side that we had the folks from the Constellation Project, all the brewery work we've done south of the border, had some of their folks participate in the music video also to say that, hey, it's not just about us, it's about everybody. It's about the owner, it's about the client, it's about the end user, it's about anybody that's going to interact with us through the process, through the project, and having the care and the wherewithal to say, hey, we want y'all to be safe too, and we want y'all to understand why safety is important to us, because it is personal.
It is, and they have to understand how much we see that involvement as a key to making everything work on the project. And in the same way as with 51, locating the local people who will add authenticity to what we're doing, they took the Constellation recording and said, that's not enough. Mm-hmm. We need to go down to Mexico, record it again, because those instruments, the feel of the area is so important.
100%.
To make that connection with people, to put it in their language, but also have it available if you weren't in Mexico. Mm-hmm. You would understand what we're getting to.
Sure.
And I thought that was wonderful that they would produce it that way. And we gave it as a gift to Constellation, but that's still a good message that everyone can take about safety. So it's fun to put it together.
Absolutely.
It's fun to have a series of these, and you talked about working with the high school, putting it into their curriculum. They're really putting an effort into that because it's not just a single song, it's not just a single message, but part of the life that we want people to live. And it's not even just on the project site. They can take it home, and if they're sending their daughter or son on their first bicycle ride, make sure you've got that helmet
on.
Think about what can happen and make sure that you do everything in order to make it as safe as it can be. So it's a learning thing that we have on the site, but it's also things that you can take into your life and insist on so that others are not hurt in the process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, John, it's been awesome having you on today. I sure appreciate your time. What I've come to know about you through this process is that you're a relatable person, right? You're a people of the people, right? You're not the chairman of the board that sits up on the pedestal and barks orders. You've come from great heritage. You come from a long line of hard workers, and you know what's great about you is the way that you drive to the job sites, the way that you make the cookies, the way that there is some well-being in it for everybody that's going to interact with Alberici. And I think that's just absolutely phenomenal.
Well, you know, we look for all the ingredients that it takes for the company to be successful, just like we look for all the ingredients that make a cookie.
Yeah.
It's not that they make themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that maybe we make up the recipe ourselves. Mm-hmm. But we put it together in a way that everybody can enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And that is a wonderful way to run a company and be a part of a company. And I'm so lucky to be part of the company that we have.
I feel the same way. And it's 107 years counting. Let's stay on for another 107.
For Flinko, it's 117.
That's exactly
so,
right.
So that is a milestone, certainly.
Yeah, no doubt. John, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's good being with you.
Absolutely. It's been such a long-